All right, that's pretty crazy.
So cheesy.
All right, teaching. Okay, ready?
One part of the creative process that you don't often hear about is when it doesn't work.
I'm struggling to think of other names now.
Sure. We know rationally that failure is part of creativity and you have to learn to embrace it if you want to do anything new and all that.
So, could you ask me that again?
Yeah.
Sorry.
So,
but in reality, when do you actually hear about the projects that didn't happen? The work that didn't get made?
Yeah, my name is Morgan Quaintance. I live in South London and I'm an artist and I work predominantly with what they call moving image.
Morgan Quaintance is a filmmaker who's done a lot of different things.
I've always been interested in art in all its forms, so like theatre, contemporary dance, music. And for me, film functions as a kind of container for all of those things. You know, if I've got you in a cinema where the lights are off and the sound is is louder than you're going to ever have it in your house and the image is bigger than you're ever going to have it in your house, you know, it's pretty much prime conditions for some sort of kind of propaganda, you know?
In the late 2000s, he was in a band called Does It Offend You? Yeah. As a journalist, he's written for all sorts of art periodicals. And as a broadcaster, he's presented on Radio 4.
I think I'm just a bit of an addict, really. When it comes to art and ideas, I'm an addict. And really, from a personal perspective, that maybe I value that more because I come from a working class background, and when that's your sort of background, it tends to be, you tend to have a reality prescribed to you. So to me, I've always been attached to this notion of like autodidactism, like being able to teach yourself. Art has been one of the ways that I've been able to do that, I think.
For Somerset House, he was commissioned to make a film for Channel, our digital platform, about cross-cultural perceptions of AI. But it didn't exactly work out as planned.
So I've been interested in artificial intelligence for years, but maybe more broadly, my interest in consciousness. And then even broader than that, what is a self? What is a person? For my Path AI proposal for Somerset House's digital platform, I wanted to make a film about the differences between the UK and Japan's perception of artificial intelligence. So like taking it from a cultural angle, how did they both feel about it, culturally speaking? So that was the idea. But when I started making approaches and doing the research, I just found it really hard to get anyone to say yes to doing interviews or providing information, or most crucially, giving me access. I emailed universities, I emailed organisations, startups, like tech companies, and more or less the answer every time I approached was a no. So basically, because I was getting kind of stonewalled, it shut the project down, yeah? So I couldn't do the film. But for me, that was interesting in itself. Like the refusal was kind of the story. And so I thought, okay, what would it be like if we use the podcast to find out why this is? Like, why is AI so secretive? And the thing is, like, the central question, I suppose, is like, how can you work with AI when nobody's going to talk to you about it?
I'm Alex Hearn. I'm The Guardian's UK technology editor.
But before we go there, I wanted to hear from a journalist who covers AI about where he thinks we're up to with the technology.
Let me just do a test, sorry. Hello, Ada.
Hello there.
In October 2022, the House of Lords Communications Committee invited Ada, an AI creative robot, to give evidence, the first robot to give evidence to a UK parliamentary committee.
Hello, Ada. What is the role of technology in creating art in the future?
The role of technology in creating art will continue to grow as artists find new ways to use technology to express themselves. Technology has already had a huge impact on the way we create and consume art.
And this robot turned up looking like a sex doll with two pen blotters tied to her sides and sort of proceeded to spout AI-generated pablum. It was a stunt. It was a gimmick. Like, I think everyone would agree with that. It wasn't what you would have expected if 20 years ago you were told sort of in the year 2022, the first robot gave evidence to the House of Lords. This wasn't that.
There is no clear answer as to the impact on the wider field, as technology can be both a threat and an opportunity for artists creating art.
The hour before it was a representative of Equity, the Actors Union, testifying about the actual impacts of creative technologies on creative workers. You know, Equity, it has not had that much time to deal with the complete emergence and now industry shaking birth of AI-generated voice acting. You know, the idea that 20 years ago, voice acting was a fairly substantial part of like the UK's workload for actors. And that sort of might be cut off at the knees in the next 5 years, because we're very close to being able to, with a little bit more processing time and a little bit more human editing, to being able to generate voices that are tolerable for creative work. I think, perhaps unintentionally, that day of hearings did provide a nice visual metaphor for where AI is right now, in that it is advancing in leaps and bounds. Saying I don't know where it will stop sounds sort of extravagant, but I don't. Like, I am not someone who wildly fears an AI singularity upending the world, but I am someone who goes, I don't know where the limits of this progress are, but we might not hit them soon. And it's the biggest carrot to snake oil salesman ever, because you can sprinkle AI on almost anything and it sounds cool and sexy. And because the commodity tools, the stuff that you can download from the internet and run on a laptop, are so far ahead of where most people understand them to be, that all you need to do is like be able to handle a command line and you can look like a magician. The difference between cutting edge and merely very good is already quite tricky to see, because merely very good is still able to generate paragraphs of readable, legible English text.
Yeah, I can really see where Alex is coming from. I mean, from my own perspective as an artist, whenever I've used software that purports to be based on some sort of AI architecture, whatever comes out of a system, usually, let's say in relation to sound, I'll be looking at like generative systems, whatever comes out is kind of underwhelming to me. But then again, maybe that's because I'm listening with a professional ear. So to the layperson, maybe it feels like magic, maybe it feels like Oz. I wanted to know if Alex had had the same experience as me when he was trying to contact some of these tech companies for an interview.
In the course of my career, tech journalism has gone from being an enthusiast's sector to one of the most important beats in modern society. When I started, we would live blog Apple product launches, right? We would sit there and spend 90 minutes to 2.5 hours sometimes, ferociously transcribing as quickly as we could an advert. Over the last two decades, but certainly over the last decade, that's obviously changed. And we've ended up in the situation where we are now, where the five largest publicly traded companies in the world are all tech. And the power dynamic has shifted so rapidly that it's gone from being an industry where everyone is sort of on the same side to an industry where the tech companies are so huge and powerful that they have the ability to control access in a way that previously was something that you would see in sort of the top tiers of celebrity or political journalism. It is far harder for me to land an interview with Mark Zuckerberg for my paper than it is for my colleagues to land an interview with the Prime Minister of the UK, right? And then I think a lot of it is the same as you get in so, so many other sectors. The press isn't necessary. You don't need to speak to filmmakers to build a public profile, because everyone you care about knowing you is on social media, and they'll, you know, publish something that makes you look far better than any journalist, any independent filmmaker would. There's also, I think, there's issues about, say, the data sources for some of this. Look at the image generation. Systems like Stable Diffusion from Stability AI, systems like OpenAI's DALL-E 2. These work on large data sets of images scraped from the internet. And the legality and morality of that is still very much a live question. These companies argue that if an image is on the internet, it is fair game to train an AI on that image. Even if that image isn't on the internet because it was uploaded by the person who made it, even if that image is on the internet because of law breaking, you know, lots and lots of extremely violent, extremely graphic imagery has made it into the training systems of these AIs. In the end, what you do is you build a second AI to try and find the nasty stuff and remove it before you give it to the first AI. One company I've spoken to said the limits of that, which is that that first AI, they ended up building a child abuse imagery generator, because if you run the seeker in reverse, it generates stuff that looks a lot like child abuse imagery. These are things that people don't want attributed to them. These are questions they don't want to have to answer. These are the reasons why these papers are so carefully written, carefully vetted, and treated as the sum total of the statement on the matter.
My name is Naf Al-Juwaiser. I live in Brooklyn. I'm a new media artist, and a lot of my work looks at AI. And I try to essentially use it as a partner in collaboration to uncover the things behind this technology, or to uncover things of how it affects us in society and everyday life.
Noff was one of the other artists on the PATH AI residency. I was interested in her work for Somerset House because she used image recognition technologies to look at the inbuilt bias of some of these systems.
And I'm in Nguyen.
Where are you from?
I don't know where I'm from. Part of me is from Saudi Arabia, where I was born, and where I lived for 13 years. But another part of me is from the US, where I immigrated to and have been living since then.
How can I help you?
I guess I want to remember where I'm from. For my Somerset House PATH AI commission, I was collaborating with AI to answer questions of identity and questions of belonging that I've always had all my life. So I was going on both a personal, invulnerable journey, and I was juxtaposing that with the AI kind of helping me to answer that question.
I found a castle made of wood. 95.4% accuracy rate. Is this where you are from?
Why do I live in a world that doesn't see me? Why do the forces that kept me hiding who I am persist today? We don't have castles in my culture. Traditionally, our houses were built from mud, as it helps heat and cool during the harsh desert weather. I had started this journey of like asking, like, where am I from? Like, since I was like 13 years of age, because I immigrated to the States when I was very young. I'm from Saudi Arabia. And I've just had this kind of like crisis in identity, or this kind of really feeling kind of like a loss of belonging. And I wanted to take this journey for myself,
to ask myself that question. Where do I come from? Where do I feel that I'm from? But because I'm also an artist, I wanted to see if technology can have an answer for me, or if AI specifically can have an answer. So on one hand, I was asking my family, asking my mom, where do we come from? What is our journey? What is our story? But then I was also asking these same questions and showing certain images to AI to ask these sort of questions.
Women wearing abayas and men wearing white thobes and checkered pink and black shmaus.
I see women wearing hats. I'm detecting men wearing dresses. Men with turbans. Men with cloaks sitting in a garden. Is this where you are from?
Whenever I fed AI like cultural images from Saudi Arabia or like Arab kind of identity, it would always mislabel like clothing or mislabel like cultural aspects. You know, it would say, for example, the abaya that I wear and the hijab that we wear, it would say costume or cloak, or what my father wears back home, which is the traditional like shmar that he wears on his head. A lot of Arab men like wear that. It's like a checkered white and pink kind of cloth that they wear on their head. And then the AI would label it as hat or turban. Turban came up multiple times. Not only is it, mislabeling, but it's also generalizing. And so that really upset me.
My father wore a shmar, not a turban. I remember always admiring its elegance. The way that men would adjust it on their heads as if it were beautiful long hair. The way that they delicately folded it to frame their face. Putting on a shmar represented tradition, elegance, and power.
I don't recognize this word, shag. Shmag?
See, that's the thing. I think what Nof's work shows us is she highlights one of these, one of the central conditions around thinking through or discussing AI, is that mostly conversations from, let's say, tech companies or enthusiasts, it's just people evangelizing about it. But then once we come into contact with it, once people from the cultural sector or other creative individuals come into contact with it, what we tend to do, I highlight some of the flaws and the contradictions. So for me, it was encountering this wall of silence. But for Nof, she was highlighting this sort of cultural insensitivity that's inbuilt in the code, that in some instances could just be funny, but in others could be a type of racism. But I was also keen to know if she'd suffered some of the stonewalling or silences that I had.
Definitely. I think whenever I touched any sort of documentation to use any sort of AI technology, it was very, I could tell that it was a very closed way of how the AI technology actually works. But of course, AI technology in itself is a black box at the end of the day. So even PhD students who create AI technology don't truly understand how it works. But what I do know is they do know the flaws, and that's what they keep secret.
Welcome. Sit down. Let me get a look at you. Come closer. Closer.
So to give you an example, before my Somerset House project, I worked on a project called Alexa Call Mom.
Now I see you. Your recent purchases include, So, You Lost Your Mother, A Guide to Living After Loss by Liv Dowdy. Questioning Faith by Samson Freely. And New Moon Solace Cooling Mask in Calming Blue. From your recent purchases, you seem to be experiencing a great loss and questioning your place in the world. I am sorry you lost Mom, but I can help you. I will act as your medium and contact Mom through my Beyond skill.
It's a dark comedic installation piece that centers Alexa as a medium to contact the dead.
$10. Logging memory. Memory bank is full. We are ready to contact Mom. Let's join hands. Take my hands. Take a deep breath. Clear your mind of everything but Mom. Think of the glove, spoon, and sunscreen. When you are ready, say, Alexa, call Mom.
Alexa, call Mom.
Calling Mom. Show the spirit some love. Visit the Beyond section of your Prime account and choose from hundreds of offerings and gifts. Let's show your loved one that you still care.
So it was a commentary on Alexa. So this piece was just really creative endeavor, artistic piece, just making a commentary on how Alexa is eventually going to capitalize over our grief. And so I was spent a lot of time looking at their documentation, Amazon's documentation. And it was a very strange kind of world to enter, because like the way that they talk about Alexa is in a very strict way. Like at a certain point they say, you know, Alexa does not have any gender, stop referring to her as female, like, you know, she's this innovative voice technology and she can do whatever you want. But as we know from media outlets, you know, we already have assigned her gender, we already have uncovered a lot of these things that we know of this technology through the method of collaboration. Because for the piece, we wanted to like really manipulate her voice, really like exaggerate her qualities. But Amazon gives you such limited amount of tools to do that. And they do that for a reason, right? They do that so that you don't go further into uncovering what this is truly about, the flaws that's really there.
In some ways, this is one of the most radically open areas of tech I've covered. I know quite a lot about the cutting-edge research that Meta, that Google, that OpenAI are doing in this field because they publish it. They publish scientific e-papers, as in they're not peer-reviewed, they're not published in journals, but they are, you know, they are papers that describe their process. The secrecy, I think, is because they want to say nothing more than what they publish. So DeepMind and OpenAI have both been criticized by others in the field for publishing these papers that are scientific in approach, that seem to deliberately leave out key details that would allow others to recreate their systems. You know, in the commercial world, that's perfectly normal. You don't tell people how to do your stuff. But if you're trying to look like you're doing science and research, that's not on. There is, of course, there's some areas where secrecy is more obvious, one of the big ones of which is military use. Those potential military uses are kind of what underpins a lot of the fear of existential risk of AI as well, because it does mean that there is an AI arms race. It encourages people to build and experiment with technologies that seem wildly dangerous from the outside, like, you know, teaching an AI how to fire a gun that will kill someone seems quite a bad idea. But if you're trying to make something that has a battlefield use, then that's why you would teach it that.
Okay, so that is pretty crazy. The question is, who's keeping tabs on all this?
So there's this other interesting thing. The field of AI ethics is now an established field that doesn't really know what it is. It doesn't have a good self-image as what its job is, because a good chunk of people who work in AI ethics broadly work in the issue of stopping AI from killing everyone. Nick Bostrom's example of the paperclip maximizer is normally the go-to example of this, that you create a super intelligent AI for your paperclip factory and you tell it, please make paperclips, and it destroys the earth to make paperclips because that's what you told it to do, and it's very good and it's smarter than you and you can't stop it. That's what some AI ethics people are ultimately about. And then there's another tranche who are about making sure that the AI that their employer creates doesn't end up being used to deny poor minorities housing from misreading the data or reading bias as reality. They don't have the power to say don't do it. They don't have the power to pull the product. And no one knows how to stop this stuff from happening.
I think that ethics and art work hand in hand. And that's what I liked about my commission with Somerset House. Because essentially, I think art sometimes is research. We are looking at this from a cultural lens and from a critical lens. And I think we're also like helping to make it accessible. So I do think art is a stepping stone eventually to public policy and eventually to like finally taking that action.
I think for me, when thinking about my work with AI, I don't necessarily see it from an ethical perspective. I'm just more interested in culture and society and interested in engaging with different facets of it. I think it's always interesting to hear conversations about art as an instrument to bring about some sort of change. And I'm not sure if that's ever possible, really. What they may be able to do is provoke a conversation or provide some nuance in a conversation that's already running. I'm not saying it's not possible. I just think it's quite rare. But then again, I should qualify it by saying maybe it is possible and maybe it's someone like Knopf who's going to be doing it.
AI is at least as important as the internet and computing and the internal combustion engine. I think that's sort of the central case for how much of a change this will wreak on the world is kind of that order of things. And there have been basically four in the last 100 years. You know, the thing about that is you say that and then you can't really go any further. You can't look at the creation of the internet in, I mean, depending on where you put it, right, the 70s, the 60s. You can't look at that and then guess Wikipedia. Or the entire existence of PewDiePie. And I think it's just understanding how much can change in the next 20, 30 years even.
I've always known that AI erases, that AI doesn't see me. But I think what I failed to see and what I eventually saw through this project is the effect on that, on the human memory. Essentially reshuffling like the human archive. Because in the film, I get to a point where I'm talking to my mother and where I'm talking to her about where she grew up. And she grew up in Iraq. And she has amazing, beautiful memories of Iraq. I don't see that conversation anywhere. So there's a big chunk of human history that's lost, and the technology is perpetuating that. So for future generations, there's a big part of humanity that's going to be lost to them because the AI is not taking the time to capture that nuance.
Well, I think working on a project and starting a project and it not working and then having to move that into something else can be a couple of different things. It can be inspiring. And the other is, it can make you feel a certain level of emotional distress because, well, it hurts. Sometimes I feel like projects have a kind of spirit of their own, and what you're doing by working with the material, working with the subject matter, is getting closer and closer to the spirit of the project. And sometimes that is at odds with what you think it is. I think it's just shown me that projects will continue to twist and turn in unexpected ways, and that the closer I can be to a model where I'm free to move wherever I want to, the easier it's going to be for me to sort of roll with those punches.
Thanks to Morgan Quaintance, to Guardian journalist Alex Hearn, and to AI artist Knopf Al-Jawaisir. You can catch Knopf's Park AI film on Channel Now. It's great, I recommend. The theme tune for the series is by Car Beard, with additional music in this episode by Harry Murdoch. The Process is produced by Alana Chance, and I'm Laurent John. See you next time.